Are you shooting my intro there, bro? Okay. That's sorry. Thanks, sorry. Great, no problem.
Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter.
and welcome everyone. This is Andrew Fetter when Pigs Fly, and welcome and thank you for listening, and thank you BBS Radio, and thank you all who are listening from past, future, present listeners. Of course, that was Orphan Land, All Is One was their song, and of course, for today's topic, and they are actually the Israeli band. There's also a Palestinian band called Kalas, and I'm going to play them at the bottom of the show. These two bands actually united in what we call Metal Brotherhood, and actually touring across the United States in a cohesive rock and roll message. I believe that it's very inductive that people with people is more important than what governments and leaders say of these people. So, with that, of course, I also want to, if you've ever heard my last show with Ben Stewart, who was the filmmaker of Chematica at Esoteric Agenda, and of course, Ungrip. Please check out my last show that I have with him. He talks about his new group, or it's not new, he's been around, Harasonic. They are now on tour across the United States. That's, if you want to Google them and find out where they are in your state, where they may be, it's HIEROSONIC. They're a great, phenomenal band. And if you're in Los Angeles, you better hurry up, because they're playing at the LA's Whiskey A Go-Go tonight. And on August 4th, this Sunday, they will be performing as the opening main act at the 2013 Zygus Media Festival in the Hollywood, California, and of course, Avalon. Do check that out. And again, that's a Harasonic. Check them out. And I'm telling you, they're a phenomenal group. I was sort of blown away. Also, do check out my last show and hear how he formed the group and whatnot. We didn't really get into his films, but got more on his one-to-one on who he is and what he is and what he's about, which is basically, you know, we're all just human beings, or basically we're spirits experiencing human experience, right? Anyway, I know I have an extraordinary show today. And hold on a second as I take a little sip of water. And it's been a little crazy right now because without internet, so I apologize if there's any pop and cracking or anything like that. They've been having problems, I guess, with servers, both all around. Some weird stuff happening, huh? Weird days these days. And it's sort of like insane in the membrane, right? Well, speaking of insanity, what would you think is insane? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That is what Albert Einstein said. And that brings in what is going on today. And of course, my subject is about the Israeli-Palestinian negotiation that is ongoing. I mean, it's supposed to be going, or it's about to be going. It's really bizarre. I'm not going to get into the specifics of how they got into this negotiation. I mean, letting out a bunch of murderers is sort of weird precondition. So to me, that was pretty phenomenal for the Israeli government too. But I was going, okay, now what did the Palestinians like do? Oh, well, just get to the table. Anyway, this is supposed to be a negotiation, or a peace negotiation between the Israelis and Palestinians. And I guess, what will be the results? Even if, let's say, an agreement is made, these people of Israel, by law now, will have to ratify it by referendum. They just voted in a referendum law, which can't even be struck down by their own constitution. That's how they made it, which is pretty smart, because if we make the leaders make a peace agreement, the people of Israel, or the people themselves, have to vote on. I think same thing should be done with the Palestinians, of course. I don't think they're going to get it because they don't have the guy who's representing the boss. It hasn't been his election, so I think it was about 10 years ago. I don't even remember now. But it's been a while, so he's not really elected. And of course, Hamas is sort of the same thing. So you have these arbitrary leaders leading a government that have never really been officially elected, representing an interest. So it begs to wonder. So that brings in the question of what, even if they do these negotiations, what's going to happen? Well, I don't think is the people of Israel or the Israelis are going to agree to divide Jerusalem. I mean, in a recent poll, there's 74% of Israelis say they reject any idea of a Palestinian capital in any portion of Jerusalem. There's only 15% that say they would support such a plan. So it's going to be really high threshold to say that they're going to come to terms of negotiated settlement, saying, okay, we're cutting the new lines and we're going to give part of Jerusalem to the Palestinians. Even if they do it, won't happen. I don't even think if it was a kolos that will happen. They're really going to have a real problem because of, like I said, and I lived in Israel for 80 to 86. I don't think that's ever going to happen. I mean, the closest time that Israelis were willing to do that, I think, was in 2000. Time has changed. Things have changed. That's over 13 years ago. A lot of people have died since then. And other thing is, I don't think in the terms of it, a lot of things have transpired that change things. You have all what's gone on with the rockets, the Hamas, the Arab Spring. People might think it's positive, but it also makes the Israelis very leery. Look what's happened with even Egypt, even with Morsi. When he was in government, then he was talking about backing off of the peace accord that they have with Egypt and Israel, blah, 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 and even they're doing it, not doing it. I mean, if I was Israel, I'd be very apprehensive of going into any real peace agreement, because peace is really based upon the people. And between people, they have to be first educated in wanting to desire that, first and foremost. If they aren't, then it's going to be almost impossible. I personally think they should be educated first, then let time pass 10 years or so, 5 years, to a period, and then go at it. But they haven't actively done it. But I'm going to go into specifics of things. So any plan, even before getting where the Palestinian one is dead on arrival, because like I said, per Abbas, there is no Palestinian state without a Jerusalem. Hence, the Israelis aren't going to go for that. Hence, the people of Israel ain't going to go for it. Even if it's put into a peace plan, no way in hell that's going to ever happen. So it's dead on arrival. So tell me, what is the point of these talks? Why is Obama, Kerry, so set on it? Unless, of course, they have a second plan, or is what some people call Plan B up their sleeve. I mean, they wouldn't be doing this unless they have something else going on. Think about what Plan B is. I'm just going to let it go. Think about it. The right, it's called, it's sort of like, it's written on the wall. But let's look first before the facts on the ground, as they say. The facts on the ground tell you everything what's going on. Without all the bullshit that you'll hear from people, whether pro or pro-Israeli or pro-Palestinian, doesn't matter. Facts on the ground talk everything. And first in reference, we have to understand, in 1993, when the first Israelis and Palestinians went into Oslo, for example, and why it died. Oslo started then, and it immediately before it even got started, it soon died right after. Why did Oslo Accord die? Well, that would be measured, as they say. Look at what has transpired since 1993. And I can say to even, let's say, both Israelis and Palestinians, how was and what was life before Oslo Accord in 1993? And they would say, are you better before or after, in this case with Oslo? So that's my question. Are they better before Oslo or better after Oslo? Let me say this. Before Oslo Accords, in fact, there were absolutely no walls. There are very few roadblocks, I can tell you for a fact. And very few, almost near, it was like, you never even heard me once a year, if anything, a terrorist activity toward any Israeli citizens. Very quiet. In fact, after the 80s, after kicking out the PLO from Lebanon, it was literally quiet. And in the West Bank, economically, and I'm telling you for a fact, the average Palestinian lived at a higher standard than even the average American. And this I know personally. I mean, I witness it. I mean, they bought cars in cash. I'm not talking little cheap cars. I'm talking about BMWs at their higher rate. You know, BMWs, Mercedes-Benz, in cash. You're talking $60,000, $70,000 cash. How many average Americans have this? I mean, they bought even smaller cars, cash, $20,000, $30,000, cash. They would build their homes in cash and not borrow. They didn't work on credit in the West Bank. They didn't run around with credit cards. Everything was cash. I remember they would stuff tens of thousands of dollars in their own tile floors, like cash. And I witnessed, I'm telling you, they had thousands of dollars in their like their special private bank, if you want to call it that. Well, you might be going, well, wait, how does this happen? I mean, the Palestinians, how do they live so well? Well, for one thing, let's go back. During the 80s and before, they were actually literally the middleman between the Israelis and the Arabs and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and the Emirates and so on. They were in the perfect position. So a lot of things could be sent from Israel to the Arab countries and vice versa. And there was no restrictions. It was almost like the middle ground. So they had within the West Bank, the Palestinian Arabs of the West Bank and Gaza had no restrictions like the Israelis on sending produce, like things they grow, whatever, in their markets, their farms, their vegetables, their grapes, their fruit, and so on. So they can send without restrictions, without being certified on what they call in Hebrew, Tu'udat Lishlach, to send produce within inside the Green Line of Israel. So they also were, while Israelis on the other hand had to adapt, had to apply by this, the Palestinians were also, literally in the West Bank, were also held the black market in currency for Israelis who often would go into the West Bank to exchange Israeli currency to foreign dollars, foreign currency like dollars, German marks, Swiss francs, or then Swiss francs because at the time that was before the euro. That was because, like, remember back then there was hyperinflation. I don't know if you remember in the 80s, those who were even born who are listening. But, yeah, with hyperinflation, I'm talking hyper, like 1,000% inflation. So Israelis would get their currency and immediately go get the dollar. In fact, I remember the years against the dollar. It was, like, unreal. It was sort of bizarre. And another thing, the Palestinians also had a major labor force that went from even Gaza and the West Bank into Israel. Now, Gaza in itself wasn't as rich as West Bank, so you can say that was always a problem. I mean, they weren't rich, but they were a poor element. They had problems always like that. So it's not the West Bank. So when people think of that, yeah, in the West Bank, they lived, the average Palestinian lived better than the American, but in the Gaza wasn't the case, so you had a duality there, if you want to call it that. But it was like totally different areas. In fact, Gaza, they speak Egyptian Arabic, and West Bank, they speak Syrian Arabic. That's a fact. They still speak like that. That tells you much of where they came from. Like I said, Gaza wasn't as rich. But in fact, it's still, and it wasn't always a poor amount as you can think of, but it still served a process. And the problem was the reason why it wasn't as also richly bodied was probably due to its geography. The West Bank served as a bridge, as opposed to Gaza was locked in that thing called inside the Sinai. And until the Sinai was given up back to Egypt, it was still sort of like locked in kind of thing. It was still locked in because there's Egypt. You know, and Israeli things still traded across. It wasn't like there was an impasse, you know, because commerce came from Israel right into Egypt after the peace accord. While in Jordan, technically they didn't have a peace accord, but they did have since 1970s a de facto peace. Actually, the Israelis had a lot long-term and better relationship with Jordan than any other Arab nations since 1970, even before the peace agreement, or even after the peace agreement of with Egypt. They had a better relationship, which is very interesting. Now, well, in fact, like I said, though the Palestinians enjoyed this, the Israelis, who were suffering from high inflation and large taxes, weren't in the same caliber. So you can see how there was a situation where they are actually living. And this is just fact. This is how it was before 1993. So how are the Palestinians doing both today in the Gaza and the West Bank today? I mean, today, it's not like then. Economic is a disaster for them. In fact, the PA, the PLO, has squandered billions and stole billions. I mean, Arafat himself, when he died, became one of the top 10 richest people in the world. He had billions. That tells you where all this money that came from your taxes from around the world that went to him, whether it's in the U.S., the EU, or whatever, that went to him and his little cohorts. They benefit from that. He literally paid things. All that money came in, he uses his political capital. He would buy paid demonstrations. They were paying, even buying arms. I mean, they paid to create things. They wanted the conflict to continue because they would get continued money. Otherwise, self-government means they'd have to self-rely on themselves. So, in fact, the PA and the PLO have squandered billions and, of course, stole billions. Now, the Hamas is no better. They have done the same thing. They came in, they became a little bit more politically less corrupt, but they became, in fact, just the same. I mean, everything that comes into there, they control borders, money, almost like mob element, taking percentages. It's like the mob, and then they're very dictatorial. They can literally seize upon things, and you have no rights. They can take over your property, your house, your home, do what the hell they want, or shoot you, and you can't do anything about it. There is absolutely no freedom or political freedom under Hamas, and in fact, the PA. It is like they are living in a prisoner. You cannot say anything about the PA or Hamas. If you do, you go to jail. This is a fact. You look at the freedoms that journalists try to do, especially Palestinian journalists, they're thrown in jail. You don't have the right to... you're literally under Sharia law. More Sharia law under Hamas and less so in PA, but it's still under a conservative, restrictive, totalitarian control. You can't say what you want. They have no freedom of press and or even freedom of religion. I mean, you look for the facts of religion right now in both the Palestinian-controlled areas, whether it's in the West Bank or Gaza. They actually have less, like, Christians or have been leaving. You can't even build a new church in Gaza. I mean, they've been destroying churches. The Christians have just upscaled left. They're not even in Gaza anymore. That tells you a lot of things. So there's no more Arab Christians and literally almost no, there might be a few, but literally almost no Christians in Gaza. And in Egypt, I mean, in the West Bank, it's been considerably to an even lesser degree, but still almost to a non-level. I mean, basically out of there. It's actually illegal, by the way, under Palestinian Authority law for a non-Muslim to marry a Muslim. Talk about, I mean, it almost sounds like, you know, it's crazy. I mean, they have their own little standards. But what was this before Oslo, and what is it after? That tells you the Palestinians live a lot better. They can say what they want. I remember behind closed doors, I talked to Palestinians, friends of mine, and I have a lot, and specifically in Tukaram area. I have Arab-Israeli friends, Palestinian-Arab-Israeli, and they often say more openly, because they're living in the Israel side, talking openly about how they enjoy being Israeli, okay, straight up. But you go in the West Bank, they're always afraid, but they still say it. You know, they would rather have who in control. I'm just telling you. That's a fact. I mean, they will say it, but not in front doors, behind the doors. This is their true feelings. You know, if they go out and say, hey, want to be Israeli, or I don't like the PA, or Palestinian Authority, or I don't like, well, of course, Hamas, would be killed, then be dragged around and be considered a traitor to the Palestinians. And, you know, it happens to them, they'll be dragged around and killed. And made examples of. That's what happens. Now, in Oslo Accord, there was an agreement, there was a letter called the Mutual Letters of Recognition. They call it the Israeli-Palestinian Liberation or Letters of Recognition. This was attached to the Oslo Accords that were signed by both. I want to read off the letter that was displaced in September 9th, 1993. It was addressed to Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister of Israel, and this is by, of course, Yasser Arafat. And I'm reading this specifically because this is his declaration that he's going to comply to. And this is part of the agreement, attached agreement of Oslo Accords. He says, the signing of the Degagrian Principle marks a new era. I would like to confirm the following PLO commitments. The PLO recognizes the right of the state of Israel to exist in peace and security. The PLO accepts the UN Security Council Resolution 242 and 338. The PLO commits itself to a peaceful resolution of the conflict between the two sides and declares that all outstanding issues relating to permanent status will be resolved through negotiations. Oh, but not through unilateral acts like they've been doing through UN and outside things and publicity and whatnot. Through negotiations only. The PLO renounces the use of terrorism or acts of violence and will assume responsibility over all PLO elements personnel in order to assure their compliance and prevent violations and disciplinary violators. Well, what happened since 1993? Their unparalleled murdering that has gone on. They've even now wanted their murders released. So you see, it's been dead on arrival. This, they were supposed to comply from very get-go. It hasn't been the case. Immediately that was done. Me, the first Jew, the first Israeli that was killed, that ended this agreement. Pure and simple. The PLO also affirms, and that's these are the articles of the Palestinian Covenant, which deny the Israel's right to exist, and the provisions of the covenant, which are inconsistent with the commitments of this letter, are now inoperable and no longer valid. Consequently, the PLO undertakes to submit to the Palestinian National Council for formal approval of the necessary in regards to the Palestinian covenant. Sincerely, Yasser Arafat. By the way, they never changed the covenant. Can you get it? So what happened? Nothing. What did Arafat do? What did the PLO and PA do? What changed in their intention before 1993 and after 1993? Why do you think we have what we have? I'm not even going to go into, well, it's because of them and that occupation or not, because that's not even correct in international terms. I don't care what anybody says. You can look. It, in reality, it's not violating any international law. It's opinion that out of politics, people question it, but it is not out of international law by any measure signed by any peace treaties which have been validated. Everything on paper has substantiated that. I don't want to get into that. But again, here we go. So like Einstein said, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. How much difference will it be from 1993 to 2013? Is there really a difference? So let's go back and look before the Brits stuck their nose into the Arab-Jewish conflict. You know, then you'll understand where the situations are. If you took all the outsiders out of the picture, took the Americans and the EU and the Brits and the French and everybody outside, including the outside Arabs of surrounding countries, and you allow them to do it, what would happen? So before, let's go back in time. First, you have to realize after the World War I, there was a guy named Sheikh Hussein, or he was actually the King Hussein of Hejaz. He was king because that was Ottoman allowed him to be the king. Plus, he was a lineage of the Hashemites, ruled of the Hejaz area. Now, King Hussein of Hejaz, he's look him up, remarkably brilliant guy. He was the guy who actually, his full name is Hussein bin Ali. He was born in 1853 in Istanbul, but he was the eldest son of the Sharif Ali ibn Mahmud and his wife, Saha Banishar. He was actually the last of the Hashemite rulers over the Hejaz, and he was appointed by the Ottoman Sultan. As a Hashemite, he was highly respected in the Islamic world. He was also had a noble lineage behind him. He had the status and maintained in Hejaz.
He was literally, as they considered, a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Even the British, during his period as Emir, recognized his very special status. If you look, he was the one, you remember if you read Lawrence of Arabia, who met with him. He was, King Ajaz was the one who helped beat the Ottomans. He was the one who liberated that area. And doing so, he thought something was going to happen. But you have to look where his mindset was. This is what was happening before the British got their noses in the area and the rest of the world. This is what he saw. And this is what, in his words, and this was came out in 1918, in his words only, we saw the Jews streaming to Palestine from Russia, Germany, Austria, Spain, America. The cause of causes could not escape those who had the gift of deeper insight. They knew that the country was for its original sons, for all their differences, a sacred and beloved homeland. This is by, again, King Hussein of Hejaz, who is, by the way, the father of King Abdullah, who became the first king of Jordan, and who is the father of the king, or also then, at that time, the Emir Faisal of Iraq. Prior to that, of course, he was king of Syria. I'm talking about the Emir Faisal. King Hussein of Hejaz was also the great-grandfather of today's King Abdullah of Jordan. I want you to keep that in mind. So, in 1919, there was a thing called the Faisal-Weizmann Agreement, which was signed. This gave the Jews their national homeland and future state subject to the Arabs having their own state. This was signed by both Emir Faisal, representing the Arabs under the guiding hand of King Hejaz, who was considered the leader of all Arabs from Arabia to Syria. Get it? He was the leader from that whole entire area, from Saudi Arabia, from Arabia, because there was no Saudi then, it was Arabia, because it was then Hashemite controlled, to, there was no Jordan, to Syria, that whole area, and the Palestinian area. He said, you know what? I'll let you guys have your little land. His idea was that it was going to become a confederate, like the Jews would have their state, their own national state, and the rest of the kingdom would be under the control of their country, and that those would have independent countries under his kingdom. So they'd have, like, almost like England had Australia, and Canada, and so on, sort of like that. And Israel, in a way, would be somewhat similar to something, but it would have its own independent country. Get it? That was sort of the idea. Well, we know what happened there. But under that agreement, it was subject to, again, to create an Israeli-Jewish state. And by the way, the borders were actually just part of, it was a little over on the other side of the boundary in the Paris Conference, west of from the Jordan all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. But that didn't happen, right? But technically, because they're Arab states, that sort of applies, wouldn't it? I mean, it's agreement signed by agreement. In 1920, the San Remo courts were also signed by both King Hejaz and the Euro nations and the United States. And these San Remo cores were created, both the Jordan, Iraq, Syria, later Lebanon, which were created. And of course, the British would be the truster of the mandatory. It's not a mandate. It's a mandatory of Palestine, which created a national homeland for the Jews until they were totally self-governed. This is stipulated, of course, in the Treaty of Lausanne, and that was also incorporated. And the territory was for the future state was from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. It says that, clear and simple. This accord was giving the Jews their country again, and it was signed again, like I said, under this Treaty of Lausanne, and it was ratified by the League of Nations and fathered into UN. So again, by net international law, every single settlement in the West Bank is technically legal. Israel is not occupying land. This is a misnomer, a political bullshit comment that is totally out of character. It would be because there was never a... technically, there was a treaty, but now it became dispute because there was a war after 47. As we know, by the way, so it is actually controlled as a sovereign land until a further accord can be reached. That technically is why it's considered disputed. Israel's sitting on their land, but it's disputed, not occupied. As we know, the Palestinians rejected the partition plan of 47, thus that point is moot. The Jordan River is literally the border until it's defined as such. But no one, by the way, ever talks about Jordan, which is really interesting. You got to remember, what was Jordan? What is Jordan? Jordan is literally a Hashemite ruler over the majority being Palestinian Arabs and a minority of Bedouins. I mean, what would happen if there was no Hashemite rule? Take out the Hashemite, what do you have? Palestinians? 87% and 13% Bedouin? So some would say, okay, but the Hashemite king still rules there, right? Well, so what's the point? Either way. Now, that is my point. This is where I come in, instead of saying, doing the crazy thing of doing the same thing and the same approach over and over, like Oslo Accord, creating another craziness within the West Bank and Gaza and doing a different plan. Goes back to what I said. So please say, what is the best approach? And I don't understand why they're running away from it, but it's the most common sense, namely the Jordan option. So you'd probably be pleased that, you know, you would think that they're, what are the Jordanians really want? Well, really, when they speak of Jordanians, are they speaking of Hashemite rule or the Jordanian Palestinians? I mean, I often hear that, hey, the Jordanians don't want that. Really? Are you sure? I mean, are you sure about that? Whether you say the Hashemite rule or the Jordanian rule, it doesn't matter. Like I said, under the Hashemite rule over Jordan came into existence based upon the Faisal Accord signed in 1909 between Chaim Weizmann and the Hashemite prince Faisal. And Article 4 of the agreement states, and I reiterate, all necessary measures shall be taken to encourage and stipulate the immigration of Jews into Palestine on a large scale and as quickly as possible settle Jewish immigrants upon the land through closer settlement and intensive cultivation of the soil. It is further due that Judaization of the British mandate for the Palestine was the very thing, by the way, the Hashemites were committed to support in exchange for establishing an Arab state under Hashemite rule. Were it not for that agreement, Abdullah's grandfather would never have become king, nor would King Abdullah II. The terms of the agreement were clear. Jews were to settle in the British mandate, or more correct, the mandatory for Palestine, with no juristic exclusion of Jerusalem. The only entitlement in Jerusalem that the agreement offered to the Hashemites was that the Muslims were to oversee the Islamic holy sites of Jerusalem. Decades later, in fact, Jews still honoring that in this agreement, allowing the Hashemites to oversee the Islamic Jerusalem. Nonetheless, the Hashemites have not honored their part of the deal, which is recognizing the Jewish right to the land. Even today, Abbas, head of the PLO and the PA, the president, formally agreed to the Hashemite control of the Muslims' holy sites in Jerusalem, if in fact we are given any type of future agreement and control of that. So he's saying, hey, you know what, this is part of the Jordanian or Hashemite control. He's himself acknowledged that very agreement that was done in 1919. So I ask, is there a path to peace? I mean, the desperate destabilization, this is by, there's an article written, you can look them up, Mudar Zaman, I believe. And if you look him up, you can Google his name. I spell M-U-D-A-R-Z-A-H-R-A-N. And he is a Palestinian Jordanian leader. And he wrote in his thing, he had an article that was pretty interesting. And this is his words. I'm going to read it to you. It says, "A path to peace. The desperate devastation measures undertaken by the Hashemite regime to maintain hold on the power to a need to revive the long-enduring solution to the Arab conflict is, in fact, the Jordanian option, which I concur. With Jordan, home to the largest percentage of Palestinians in the world, it is a more logical location for establishing a Palestinian state than any other soil, including Israel." Here's even a Jordanian Palestinian saying the same thing, which I'm implying and haven't gotten to. There is, in fact, most nothing un-Palestinian about Jordan except for the royal family, who, in fact, is from where? Arabia. Now, for decades, however, regional players have been entertaining fears about empowering the Palestinians of Jordan. And there may be an apprehension that Jordan as a Palestinian would be hostile to Israel or support terror attacks across the border, and such concerns are somewhat legitimate but are really puzzling, of course. Israel has allowed the Palestinians to establish their own entities, as well as their own police and para forces, even on the captured area within after the 67 war. I mean, look at it. Even they have maintain its own major population, Israeli population centers. Would a Palestinian state on the other side of Jordan pose any real great threat to Israel than the one that would be put into Judea or Samaria? Now, he also plays out, it could be argued that should the Palestinians control Jordan, they would downsize the military institutions which are dominated by their Bedouin rivals. A Palestinian-ruled Amman might also seek to cut back on the current scale of military expenditure and hope that the U.S. military presence in the world would protect the country from unwelcome encroachments by Damascus and Tehran. Of course, we all know what happened in the 70s when Syria, under Assad's father, tried to attack Jordan. And of course, Tehran's influence, talking about Iran, it could also greatly benefit from the financial and economical incentives of attending good neighbor relations with Israel. This is, by the way, a given. Even if a Jordanian army under Palestinian commanders were to be kept at its current level, it would still be well below any of Israel's military and technological edge. After all, it's Israelis. This is by him, a Palestinian Jordanian saying it. Israel's military support, rather than its regional goodwill, that drove some of the Arab states to make peace with it. The Palestinians in Jordan already depend on Israel for water and have been enjoying a thriving economic boom by what they call the qualified industrial zones, which allow for Jordanian clothing factories to export apparel to the United States as preferred tariffs. If a minimum percentage of raw material comes from Israel. Hundreds of Palestinian factories have prospered because of these industrial zones. Expanding such cooperation between a future Palestinian state in Jordan and Israel would give the Palestinians even more reasons to maintain a good relationship with their neighbor. Both the United States and Israel should reconsider and reevaluate the Jordan option. This is coming from a Jordanian Palestinian again. He says, given the unpopularity at present of the Hashemite regime among its subjects, regime change in mind should not be that difficult to achieve, though achieve eternal intervention would likely yield results that the wait and see comes to power approach followed through during, for example, the Egyptian revolution. We saw what's happening there. After 12 years on the throne and $7 billion in U.S. aid, Abdullah is still running a leaking ship and creating obstacles in resolving the Palestinian issue. Now, that's coming from a Palestinian Jordanian. If you want to look at what the Hashemites' intention was, King Abdullah's father, there was a London agreement, you can look this up, it was called the London Agreement between King Hussein of Jordan and Israeli Foreign Affairs Minister Shimon Peres. and they entered an agreement signed within a secret mailing held in the residence of Lord Mishan in London on April 11, 1987. Also present in the meeting were Jordanian Prime Minister Zayed al-Rafai and Director of Israeli Foreign Affairs, Yossi Bilin. And of course, this agreement, and by the way, Yossi Bilin probably rings a bell, he was one who helped put together the Oslo Accords. Now, the agreement outlines the framework for an international conference hosted by the United Nations, whose purpose is the peaceful solution of the Arab-Israeli conflict based on Resolution 242 and 338, and a peaceful solution of the Palestinian problem in all aspects. The agreement also stipulates that the conference would not impose a solution on the parties and that all Palestinians would be represented by the Jordanian delegation. Its requirements that all parties accept the 242 and 338 mandates of the UN, resolutions thereof, as well as renounce violence and terrorism effective, excluding PLO participation. The signatures agreed that their plan would be presented to the Secretary of State of the United States under George Shultz for its promotion as an American initiative. Paris, serving as a foreign affairs on behalf of the Labor Party in Israel and the National Unity Government, left for the meeting with consent from Prime Minister that of then Yitzhak Shamir of the Likud. And then, of course, they were hoping for a major breakthrough, and which it would lead to this promotion of a Jordanian option, namely the resolution of the Palestinian issue through the Jordanian sovereignty over the West Bank, the Jordanian sovereignty within the West Bank. But, of course, there was mistrust between both leaders of ideological differences led between Shamir and, of course, Peres, which is... Peres stupidly would not disclose it. Shamir was also... It was out of both their egos that nothing transpired out of this agreement. Sad to say. That's true. That's where Israel fucked up. They would never be in this situation now. Of course, Hussein was bitterly disappointed by Peres' inability to realize the agreement. This is, by the way, writings out of WikiLeaks, if you're well, I mean, Wikipedia. So I'm just reading up a little element of it, and it stipulated this. But Hussein was bitterly disappointed by Peres' inability to realize the agreement and constantly disengaged from any further initiative. This is what happened. In 1988, King Hussein removed all decision from all Palestinians living in the West Bank. And by the way, this is what led to the first Enfidia. Not the bullshit that everybody tells you. I'm telling you, I know for a fact. All the Palestinians living there in the West Bank were Jordanians. Bingo, all of a sudden they had nothing. There was a void. They didn't know what they were. Because that citizenship was revoked, they couldn't go back and forth into Jordan. And that's when it changed. It was all because of economics. You see, people are people. People just want to live. That's the bottom line. Anyway, on either account, with the Hashemite rule over Jordan or Palestinian, here's what I propose. This is my idea. This is what I want to present. Those who are listening, maybe tell them up, but it's something, maybe seeds. Some of this stuff is probably already part of similar to an Alon plan. People may have heard that. Whatever. This is the idea. I think it would work. Whether it's whoever's the rule, like I said, Hashemite or Palestinian, it doesn't matter. It's the same. It's my version of the Jordanian politician, which I would think that would settle the Palestinian-Israeli conflict once and for all. In fact, it would settle the Arab conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict. There is a current Israeli-Jordanian peace accord, correct? So it would be simply amended. First, the PA, the Palestinian Authority, would immediately be dissolved and all its administration handed over directly to Jordan. All Palestinians living in the West Bank, namely Judea and Samaria, will immediately receive full Jordanian citizenship. Areas A and B under the Oslo Accord will be under the jurisdiction of Jordan. Area C will fall under the jurisdiction of Israel, with, of course, mutual security arrangements. All PA laws will be null and void. Israel and Jordan will thus enter a mutual control of the West Bank, subject to areas A, B, and C designated in the Oslo Accord. Egypt will have under its sovereignty Gaza and immediately give all Gazans immediate Egyptian citizenship. All Palestinians living as refugees will be granted full citizenship by their host country, or the host country will be obligated to provide a secondary country for immediate citizenship. All original refugees, both Jews and Arabs, dispersed between 1947 through 1960, will receive compensation via the United Nations. All Palestinian refugee camps and organizations will be immediately be dissolved. So my question, why isn't this being pursued when it is so obvious? That is my question. The Jordan option is the best and only option that will solve this once and for all. My question, why isn't this being pursued? People are people who live there. Again, why is this not being pursued? Does in fact the UN, the US, the UK, the EU wish this conflict to continue? I sometimes wonder, is it perhaps because they want more arms to be purchased, which means more money? More instability, perhaps oil goes up. More instability. The banks have always earned more from every conflict since 1913. Perhaps they have an interest. Think again. It is. People are people. I don't care whether they're Jew or Arab or otherwise. So why not just do the obvious? Perhaps the Jordan option is the plan B. With the special secret meetings between King Abdullah and Bibi Netanyahu, and even Kerry and even Abbas, is this just a dog and pony show that they go to the Jordan option to save face for the Palestinians who have been manipulated by the outsiders like the United Kingdom, the United States of America, the EU, the European Union, and of course the UN Nations, and they've been sold some BS of a Palestinian state when in fact no one has come to the truth and tell them the fact is that they've always had one and it's called Jordan? This is not a right-wing solution. It is the solution. This is not a left or right. This is an absolute fact on the ground and a fact of history. And if the truth was what they want, then there will be peace. Here it is. If they truly want peace, here it is. It's yours. It's always been there. And it's time for the United States of America, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and the UN to step to the plate and initiate the obvious, the Jordan option. Some say King Abdullah's rule is numbered. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. But it's obvious, even if the king does not abdicate, who is the heir to the throne of Jordan? It is a Palestinian. Who is presently the queen of Jordan? A Palestinian. In other words, it doesn't matter. It's quid pro quo. Like the late King Hussein of Jordan said, Jordan is Palestinian and is Palestine, and Palestine is Jordan. Again, this is people and people, not governments. And not governments of governments. People are people. And peace is between people and people, not governments and governments. Let us remember that people are not born to hate. They are taught to hate. Let us teach real peace with real options, with a real reality. That's what I say. The Jordan option, as I stated in my proposal, will do just that. And I want to thank you. God bless you all. But first, I'm going to close. Like I said, check them both out. These two Israeli bands I've mentioned have united in a metal brotherhood, in fact,
One is called Orphanland, that's the Israeli, and Kalas. I've taken message across a coexistence through the rock and roll across the Europe. And now I'm going to close with Kalas playing Amona. God bless you all and have a glorious, glorious weekend. God bless and thank you.
Yeah, baby.